We started the Ananda community, which is the place where many of us live, just a few miles up the road here, and where others of you could live if you would like to. We began to lease the property, we don't own it, in 1989, I think it was. And about a year after we moved in September, and then the following summer, when we'd had a chance to fix the place up a little bit, Swami Kriyananda came down and we had a gala celebration and he dedicated the community for us. It was already dedicated. In fact, it was a most interesting experience. The property that we arranged to lease is an apartment complex. As it happens, it has a little more land than most apartment complexes in the area. Because we knew we would be moving in and having all the other tenants leave, we wanted to have a complex where, well, there were two factors at work here, where people weren't too settled, because if we were going to evict them and they'd been there for 20 years, it would not be really an auspicious start for our community. At the same time, we weren't, a group of friendly investors was buying the property for us to use, and costs being what they are here, the more dilapidated the buildings were, the closer it was to our price range. And dilapidated buildings and people who move in and out were really something that went together. So we managed to find it without too much trouble. We found a place where the transient population and collapsing buildings. No, excuse me. The term of art is there was a great deal of deferred maintenance. And so there was a great deal of deferred maintenance and the population was a transitory population. So we moved in and then gradually everyone else moved out and Ananda took it over. Those of you who see it now, it's just absolutely beautiful. You can't even remember, you can't even imagine what it was when we first moved in. Because it wasn't only a question of the physical vibration, it was mostly the physical reality, it was the actual vibration. And it did not have a very high consciousness. The people who lived there just had a different attitude toward life. There's this beautiful inner courtyard, and it was filled with gum wrappers and candy wrappers and cigarette packs and beer cans. I mean, people would just walk out from their house and just drop the trash out of their pockets. It's just a kind of lack of awareness that is not characteristic of people who find their way onto this path. My favorite story of that kind, life is so marvelous. This man would sit in the upstairs apartment, which had a little balcony, which overhung the downstairs apartment, which had a little patio. And after he finished reading his Sunday paper, he just threw it over the balcony. I mean, it was out of his world, you know. The ego sphere is this big, and I'm finished, and anything else outside of the sphere of my ego isn't me, and therefore I'll just drop, you know, so somebody's down there, and the newspaper just falls. Maybe the person before thought it was a free newspaper. I don't really know. Once when we were in the very beginning living there, we lived on the side where it faced onto where the driveway was. And at 7 or 6 in the morning on a Saturday, somebody started working on their car in the driveway, just literally feet from our bedroom window. And they just turned the radio on full blast at 6 or 7 in the morning so that the entire complex was treated to their particular taste in music, which was definitely not mine. But even if it had been, and as I lay there, wide awake, thinking, now this person, later on in his life, people are going to treat him without consideration for his realities. And he's going to be so shocked. Because the cause and effect relationship is obviously not very clear in his mind, because his life is circumscribed by his ego. I'm going out to work on my car. This is the time I have. When I work on my car, I turn on the radio. And just everything else is separate from me. Now, that really, it's no different. Someone was speaking recently about a particular peculiarity of someone's life, how they spent a lot of money in this way and then counteracted the good effect that they were spending on this side by the habits on this side. And it wasn't even spoken judgmentally. It wasn't spoken judgmentally. It was just a comment. And all I could think of is what I said. When you're not in a delusion, it seems like such a delusion. It doesn't it? But when you're in it, if you thought of it as a delusion, you wouldn't do it, would you? You think this is going to make you happy. It's too much trouble to throw away the newspaper. I'll just throw it over the balcony. I want to work on my car. I'll just turn on the radio. And there's not this capacity to sort of see how everything plays together. I sat once with Swami Kriyananda. This, I think I've had a lot of embarrassing moments in retrospect of that type. But I think this really was the apex or the nadir for me with Swamiji. I was just in a state of, everything was too difficult for me. I can't remember, thank God, what the domino effect of pressures was. But I was just sort of disintegrated, and I was looking for a way out. And I said to Swami, words very close to this, if I just didn't have all this pressure, you know, in essence, to realize God and be a good person, it would be so much easier, wouldn't it? Swami didn't even dignify it with a response. He just sort of, he has this way, he sort of looked at the ground like that. Then he just looked at me. I mean, there was, he wasn't actually speechless, but I think everything that he thought of that he could say, he didn't want to say, because he wanted me to be able to, you know, keep going, such as, yeah, if life were easier, it wouldn't be so hard. Yes, that's true, you know, but what he was really saying, what I was really saying, I talked about this the last time I was in here, so I won't belabor it. I was at that stage called the second stage of the little bird's life, where God says, this is how the laws of life work. This is the flow. You're on a mission. You gather, you multiply, you expand, you give. And the little bird says, ha, but what else is wisdom if not to keep what is mine for myself? In other words, you're telling me that I'm a part of all that is, but I don't think so. I think I'm a part of just me. And I think the more that I cling and live by whatever little values I see, the happier I'll be. Isn't that right? That's what I sat and said to Swamiji. If God had just made the universe very different than he actually made it, and if the world would just conform to my ideas, everything would be better, wouldn't it? I mean, what are you supposed to say? I'm going to eat nothing but chocolate cake, I'm never going to exercise, and I'm going to be really healthy and live a long time, right? And just somehow, your sheer determination to make it true doesn't have a whit of effect on what happens if you eat nothing but chocolate cake. You can get away from it with it for a little while, but sooner or later, the whole system is going to fall to pieces. Or if you're lucky enough to have stored up a good enough health karma in the past, you might be able to run even a whole incarnation on chocolate cake. But then the next time, no matter what you do with that body, it's just going to fall apart time after time. And again, it'll be so mysterious. Oh, woe is me. Why is this happening? Because there's a bigger reality. That's what our reading is about today. It's this absolutely marvelous, simple image that Jesus puts forth. I am the vine. I, the infinite spirit, am the vine. And you, though you may think you're this great independent thing, you're just a little branch. That's all you are. Where do we think our life and power comes from? I mean, really just think about it. Did we create even our own bodies? You know, I look in the mirror and I watch this body just change. I mean, I'm of an age where it's just changing. And there's nothing I can do about it. I can just kind of hold on to the edge of the sink and stand in the mirror and demand that it look different. I can get up one morning and say, I want to be 30 again. I mean, I will get to be 30 again, but not as Asha, not in this form. And that's not really an affirmation I want. You know, oh, let me have body after body after body so I can do this whole thing again and again and again. One of my friend's relatives, in the way that all of these things are permeating into popular culture, she heard about reincarnation. Very wealthy, extremely materialistic woman. This, my friend, was her nephew. She was so excited because she vaguely knew that he was into this sort of things. Guess what, she said, we get to come back. You know, complete opposite of the idea that we're trying to escape from the wheel of incarnation. Her thought was, I'm enjoying myself so much, all my money, all my pleasures, and that, you know, when I die, it's not over. I just get to do it again. Yeah. I mean, he was speechless. It was one of those, ah. Mm. Swamiji has another response, which is, ah. Ah. Just sort of what I call sympathetic clucking noises. Ah, you know. Somebody's just telling you something that to them is not a delusion. It's not time. It's not even right. It's not really right to undermine people's reality with the force of your will. People just have to run this cycle themselves. Well, coming all the way back to where I was starting when I was talking about the dedication of our community, as you might expect, the effort, and this was in 1989, so this was very early in the sphere of Ananda's experience under David and my leadership here. And we moved here in 87, and we sort of set our minds to this idea of creating a community. And those were very, very, very busy years. We had a staff, but it was not anything like the glorious group that we have now. And we had very good people, but many fewer of them. The whole thing was so much smaller, and it was a great deal just on our shoulders. We just worked day and night. We used to go over, this is before cell phones were so common, we used to go over to Half Moon Bay to the little tea shop that used to be there, and we'd drink a lot of caffeinated tea and make plans like this, and we'd get us away from the phones. One day, though, we drove all the way over to Half Moon Bay. We parked by the ocean. We were so tired, we put the seats back. We slept for an hour and a half. We put the seats up and we drove home. I don't think we ever even opened the windows. We never opened the doors. We just took a break and rested. Well, after all that, you naturally feel when you're working that hard. Not that we minded it at all. We thrive on that sort of thing. But after all that effort, 2 years of effort, essentially, and then we get into the community. We had to do so much work to renovate it. And there was all this enormous sense of we're doing it. This is happening. So many good ideas. And then we have this dedication service. And it's just beautiful. We just went to so much trouble. We had this beautiful stage set up, and Swamiji was sitting there. And naturally, David and I both spoke a little bit before Swamiji spoke. And I'm standing here like this, and I think Swami was in a relationship to me about where David is standing. Now, he was enough behind me. And I began to speak. And I was just talking about, we did this, we did that, we did this. All of a sudden, it was as if my consciousness just went out. I don't mean I went into a superconscious state. It was more like I just had this sudden perspective. And I felt, Swamiji often tells this amusing story about he took some European friends to Disneyland. And this man, who was the father of the family and very much of the patriarch of the family, he had daughters and children he'd always taken care of. And they went on the little boat ride that floats on the lake. And they have a little steering wheel. And the steering wheel gives you the impression that you can do it. And so he's riding. His name was Johnny. He's driving this little boat along like this, and he has his wife in the car with him, and Swamiji's in another car, and he waves and sort of starts a conversation with Johnny, and Johnny says, I can't talk now, I have to drive this boat. I don't know what he thought he was doing. Of course, the boat was on a track. He could have just let go and leaned back, and it was going to go wherever it was going to go. And of course, afterwards, they teased him enormously, but he just never conceived of such a thing. Well, here I am. 2 years of hard work, you know, all this tremendous effort to we have manifested this community. I just all of a sudden felt, who do you think you're kidding? You know, you've been on a track. You think you've been steering. Maybe you've been pedaling a little, but I'm not even sure you've been doing that. I think you've just been on the treadmill. It was sort of like you had to put out a certain amount of energy because energy is required. In fact, there's I think I'm going to be able to remember all the steps of this. I'll get all the way back. When Ananda Village was very new in the early 70s. This very wonderful spiritual teacher who's now on the other side, his name was Sant Keshav Das, he came to visit. And he looked around and he understood something that we were too young to understand. And Ananda Village, many of you have been there now, it's almost 1,000 acres, 250 people live there. There's schools, there's businesses, there's beautiful homes, there's gardens, there's paved roads. Visualize nothing. Visualize one piece of land with absolutely nothing on it, not nothing but a well. Visualize another with an old ratty barn and an old ratty farmhouse. Everything else was created by the people there, everything. I mean, it's hard to conceive of that, but everything. And in the 70s, it was still fairly ratty, but it was coming up. Sant Keshav Das looked at it, and he turned to Swami. He said, somebody did a lot of tapasya to make this happen. You must have done a lot of tapasya to make this happen. Swami just said quietly, yes. The word tapasya is a very interesting word in Sanskrit, because it's usually translated to mean austerities, sacrifice. In fact, when Swamiji was giving out spiritual names, you always were a little afraid that your name would have the word tapasya in it. You know, Tapasya Dasi or Tapasya Nanda or, you know, Sri Tapasya or just anything. You didn't want that word at all. Because it had that bit of you know, I don't get to eat anymore but roots and berries kind of feeling about it. We were watching once at Ananda Village a movie that was in Hindi, a beautiful movie about a Saint Gyandev. And none of us in the community understood any Hindi, and it was going on. But we heard one of the characters say, in a very dramatic, over-dramatic Indian movie style, tapasya, like that. And then the subtitle said, devotion. And we all laughed, because we just, I don't know. And then later we were talking to Swamiji, we said, oh, well, they mistranslated that word. He said, oh, no, that's also the definition of the word tapasya. Now, isn't that a beautiful thought? Because what is sacrifice? If you're doing, for example, let's say, well, I read a wonderful book about Georgia O'Keeffe, the artist. Georgia O'Keeffe, her life is very, very inspiring, but you see why she did such beautiful art. Because she was born to paint, and she just very gradually pushed everything else out of her life so she could paint. If you're trying to build a company, if you're trying to raise a baby, if you're trying to make a garden, you can't watch a lot of television. At some point, you have to make sacrifices in order to bring your energy to some kind of a focus to do something. But if in the end you have accomplished something you really want to accomplish, was it a sacrifice? Is it less of a sacrifice to just dissipate your energy in all directions and end up with nothing? That kind of seems to me like more of a sacrifice, doesn't it? And if you do it not because you're chained to the wheel and can't get off of it, but because you understand the power and the beauty of what you're trying to create and you don't count the cost, why would you care? You know, a mother gives to her child and loves giving to that child. When the first friend I knew well had a baby, and that baby was a toddler, and she came to visit me, and she was constantly engaged with that baby. So much so that all of you know who've raised babies, that we could hardly finish a sentence because there was always something happening to the child. And after a little while, even though I've never had babies, I'm an instinctive mother, I understand children in that way, but still I said to her, how can you stand it? Just like that. She said, she sort of looked a little like this at me, very puzzled. And then she said, oh, I understand. She said, when you look at us, you see two. She said, there's really only one here. It was a perfect answer. Isn't that a sweet answer? I've never forgotten it. Well, when we see the world as other and something is asked of us, we feel divided by what's being asked of us. Something is being sacrificed for the sake of something else. But if you see the world as one and you're acting only with love, where is the sacrifice? Because there's no separation. One of my friends was teaching a class about stress. I have my fingers like this in anticipation of the fact that if you have a rubber band on two fingers like this stretched out, this is how she would demonstrate it. You hold the rubber band fixed and you pull on this one, there's more and more tension, isn't it? But if, as this one pulls, this one simply goes with it, you see there's no tension. The tension is only when something is happening and you resist it. If you move with it within the sphere of the circle, so to speak, then it never becomes tense. It's just what you do. You see, this is devotion. Because if this is your goal and you must go with it, there's no sacrifice. The word tapasya can look like tapasya, but it looks only like devotion. Now, we can't do that if I am in charge and I'm the only one. And the reason we're so stressed is because we're not in charge and we're not the only one. And that reality is constantly bashing us over the head. And we are constantly asserting that it can't be true. We're constantly sitting in front of the equivalent of Swami Kriyananda and saying, if it were just easier, I'd be happier. Right? And what can anyone answer? God himself can't change his laws for us. The chocolate cake does not build a strong body. And it's not God's fault. It's just the way reality is. Well, back to keep backing this back up. I'm standing in front of Swami Kriyananda, in front of many of you and quite a few others. And I'm talking about all that we did. And all of a sudden, I felt, even though the incident at Disneyland had already happened, I felt just like Johnny Golia riding that silly little boat and driving it myself. And I was vividly aware that the tractor beam was coming from right behind me. that Swami Kriyananda has a commission from Paramahansa Yogananda. Master said, go north, go south, go east, go west, cover the world with little colonies. We can demonstrate that plain living and high thinking is the way to happiness. This mission of building communities is not something that we thought, oh, that'll be fun. This was Paramahansa Yogananda coming to this world to make this happen. It's the lifestyle pattern of the future. That's what Yogananda said. Swami Kriyananda has gone so far as to say 50 years from now, they're going to look back at these communities and realize it was one of the most important things happening, not only in the country, but in the world. That's a very bold statement. I wouldn't make it, but Swami has made it, unequivocally made it. Master said, someday this idea of communities will spread like wildfire. Because it's really partly because we are an enclave within a rather inharmonious world. And if you live among people who share your ideals, every time you see another devotee, it reminds you of what you're doing. Your neighbors are your friends. Your neighbors are your soulmates. It just makes life so completely different. When Swamiji finally stood up to speak, it was very interesting. He said, Babaji is very pleased with what's happening here. You think Babaji, this deathless yogi living up in the Himalayas without a time of birth, promising to stay in his body till the end of this incarnation, and he's pleased because 240 Monroe has turned into a community? But he said this is just what the masters had in mind, that those of like mind who have aspiration would come together and live in a different way. Now, I've always known this from my heart. When I met Swami Kriyananda when I was 22 years old, one of the things that was so thrilling was that there was this community. There was a way to make life, total life, completely different. You just didn't have to go on and then just sort of paste a little bit, you know, onto it. Maybe some people are happy. Maybe that's some people's karma, which I know it is. And I'm going to put a caveat on this. Don't let me forget. If I fold my hands and say I'm finished, somebody raise their hand, because I want to put that clearly. But I'm standing here at that dedication, speaking as if I myself had done something. And the absolute folly of that was so transparent to me, I actually had to back up a little bit and stand a little bit behind Swamiji. I just couldn't stand with my back to him anymore, because I could just feel Master's idea came to him. And Swami himself, years later, wrote in a book, he said, my way of leading is not to tell people what to do. He said, but I project thoughts into the ether, and if people who are in tune with them pick them up. Or he projects thoughts directly at us. In the 20 years that David and I have been working, nearly 20 years have been working in this colony, there have been two occasions when Swamiji actually told us directly what to do. I mean, and we've discussed things with him, but even then he's always been a little circumspect about it. When we first left Ananda Village to come here, David said, what would you like us to do? Swami's answer, vintage Kriyananda. How would I know? He said. He said, you're the one who's going to be there. Why don't you go down there and then you can tell me and then we can talk about it. Now, on one hand, that's true, because it doesn't work to just impose thoughts on people. Then they become automatons. They can't be creative. But it's equally false to think, oh, now I'm in charge. And so he was able to say that to David because there was no thought on David's part that now I'm going to do my thing. It was just how to express this vibration. You have to be on the scene. You have to be original. You can't determine it from a distance. You have to be there and feel it. But all the while, Swamiji was projecting thoughts to us. In fact, in this little interview book of, I can't even remember what it's called, but it's about community that Sarah Crier did. She interviewed maybe 25 people and then wrote up their stories about their life in community. And that might be the name of the book. Pardon me? Reflections on Community. Two people in that book, mostly for humorous effect, spoke. One woman spoke of how Swami just gave she and her husband this great responsibility and then sort of set them up and then drove away and just more or less abandoned them on the doorstep, and they had to just turn around and suddenly take care of this huge project. Another man wrote in a similar way about how Swami never really told him anything. He never gave him any guidance, in essence. Both of those, when Swami read them, he called both those people up. He said, I never abandoned you. With great force, I never abandoned you. I was always with you in my consciousness. And he had Sarah change the book because it just was the wrong thought. It wasn't that he minded what they said about him. And in both cases, they were overstating it to be humorous, really. But he wanted them to understand, I never abandoned you. Now, Swamiji acts in our lives on behalf of Master. And it's a very wrong thought to think that the Master ever abandons us. We stop receiving. Now, what do we say in the Festival of Light every week? As many as received him, to them gave he the power. Now, Swamiji carried over very little from the entire New Testament, but every week, as many as received him. Because it is not a question of whether that energy is coming forward. It's a question of whether or not we are receiving it. Where do our ideas come from? You think they come from your own mind? You know, we're always a channel for something. The question is, what are you going to be a channel for? There's no such thing as independence. I'm going to insert this little thought because I said I would give this caveat. You have to also understand that God will guide you according to what's right for you. So it's not that you have to be guided by some theoretical thought. There was a satsang that Swami gave a number of years ago. And it was, we have two orders within our community. One is the monastic order, which is called the Sevakas, and then the Sadhakas, which are, as we call, the lay order. And most of the lay order people are people whose karma involves them in two realities. They're not able to be entirely in Ananda. They have other realities, maybe family responsibilities, career responsibilities, whatever it might be. Not necessarily unspiritual, but just parallel tracks. The Sevaka order is essentially the army. It's the group that can say, you're needed in Dallas, and you can say, yes, sir, I'll go. Whereas certain other people might be equally dedicated, but their family and their children would make it impossible for them to move like that. So Swami was giving a satsang for the lay order group. And he asked us, the sadhaka group, he asked us, what should I talk about? We said, well, why don't you talk about what it means to be a lay member? Seems like a good idea. So Swami sat down, and for about an hour, he talked about his own life of absolute renunciation, about how nothing matters to him. That he has no attachment, no expectations, that he lives only for Master. And then he talked about how he was expelled from SRF in 1962, and he ended up 36 years old, completely penniless, separated from every friend he had in the world, forbidden by SRF to contact anybody in SRF. He was just absolutely alone. And his parents, fortunately his parents who lived right over in Atherton at the time, he lived with them, and he began slowly to put his life together, and he started teaching, and he used one of their cars. And his parents wanted to give him that car. And he kept saying no, he wouldn't take that car. And he said to us, and his voice choked with emotion, and this is just a group of you all. You know, people like us, we have cars, we have houses, we have furniture, we have jewelry, we have children, we have all kinds of things that are ours. Swami just looked at us with so much feeling. He said, it's impossible for me to explain to you how intensely painful it was for me, even the thought of having to own something as expensive as a car. He said, I'm sure you can't even understand. He said, but it was agony for me. I was a monk, I had given my life to God, and until then he'd lived in a monastery. And now he was out of the monastery. Now he was going to have to own a car like that. And then the satsang finished. And then he said, is there anything else I should talk about? I said, why don't you talk about what it means to be a lay member? Swami said, that's all I have been talking about. Then he turned to the group and he said, you have to live what is appropriate for you. He said, it wouldn't even be right for you to try to live at the level that I'm living. He said, you have to be guided by God according to what is right for your own heart. Wasn't that interesting? Now, that is a very, very, very fine line. Because you can't also say, oh yes, what I'm doing is just exactly the highest and the best. But to have the courage and the strength of heart to say, this is how God is guiding me. And I know this is how God is guiding me. And you don't get that by burning all your belongings and going out naked into the world. There was this young man once who became inspired that way. This is a long sermon, but I'm almost done. There was this young man at Ananda Village once who became inspired that way. He went into his cabin at the retreat and he shaved all his hair off. He did this all by himself. Shaved all his hair off. This was when where Swami would speak was in front of this sort of manzanita bushes at the seclusion retreat. All the audience was here and Swami had his back to these bushes. This man comes creeping around. He's taken off all his clothes. He's absolutely stark naked. He has all his belongings in a little bundle. He's shaved his head. And so he comes, it was also just absolutely marvelous because the whole audience saw him long before Swami did. So you see this naked man creeping up behind Swami, and Swami just continues to lecture, just, you know, because he doesn't know. Finally, this man comes around in front, his name was Francesco, and he just throws himself at Swami's feet, puts his little bundle of clothes there, and he just, this full prostration, stark naked like this. And Swamiji just keeps lecturing. And the retreat manager is sort of moving, and Swami just kind of signals him, just stay. So for a few minutes, Francesco is just offering himself at Swami's feet, and Swami's just lecturing. And then Swami, so sweetly, he just says to the whole audience, sometimes these things happen, meaning that people get carried away, don't worry about it. And I think he would have just finished this whole class with this naked man in front of him. Somebody, I think, threw a blanket over him. But Francesco wasn't content. He began to inch forward and he began to sob a little more loudly. Finally, he grabbed Swami's ankles and began to sob on his feet, at which point it was too distracting. And Swami just very sweetly said, Francesco, put your clothes back on, like that. And then he sort of signaled and a couple of the men came and sort of helped him up and, you know, took him away. But you know, sometimes we go a little too far, and Francesco calmed down, and his hair grew back, and he put his clothes back on, you know. It was fine. It was just a little overzealous, but it was well-intentioned, and we all do that. That's not the same as being guided by the infinite. It's a deep inner understanding that our lives are not our own, that we must, as Swamiji said something so sweetly, he said, when I became a disciple of Master, I merged my interests with my Guru. It's such a simple phrase, but it touched my heart so deeply. I merged my interests with my Guru. That's what we need to do. We need to merge all of our interests with the infinite. And so that whatever it is that we're guided to do, we act in concert with that. Really, friends, we're all in Disneyland, and the whole thing is on a little track anyway. Just depends how much play we have in the wheel. You know, but let's narrow it so that we just don't waste all that energy, but just do what we have to do in our little boat, but ride all the time with God.